number one, class number two, TH-401, Book of Romans. Now, we were talking about Gamaliel and the school that he operated. And one of the things, again, that I want to emphasize very highly is that this school was a major, major educational institution within the Jewish nation, meaning within, you know, the Jewish people. That school at Jerusalem was highly, highly respected. And if it was known that you were a graduate of that school, then people tend to give you a little more attention. You know, they tended to think that you knew more than other people or whatever, whether you did or not, that, you know, they tended to believe that way. And because of the structure of that school and how strict it was, Gamaliel, he was a very tough teacher, but he was a very thorough teacher. And the impression that I have gotten from reading about him is that he was stern, but he was also fair, compassionate. I mean, he wasn't a meanie, but, you know, he got his point across. And so the students that would graduate from his school, they were highly proficient when it came to understanding the law, because it went beyond just that synagogue school that Paul would have attended in Tarsus. This school, call it graduate school if you want to, it was very, very tough. But boy, when you were done, you knew the law inside and out. You knew what it meant to be a Jew inside and out. It was very clear. And Paul, his father was a Pharisee. Turn over to Acts 23. His father was a Pharisee and probably is the one that would have insisted that Paul go to that school. In Acts chapter 23, take a look in verse 6. But when Paul perceived that the one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, "Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Of the hope and resurrection of the dead, I am called in question." So Paul's dad was a Pharisee. Now what this means is, there's probably a good chance that that Paul's dad also went to this school. Now, whether he actually sat under Gamaliel during that the time that he was there, we're not sure. But because of Gamaliel's age, Paul's dad probably had him as a teacher. So that would have made it even easier for, you know, with Paul's dad being an alumni, it would have been easier, you know, for him to get Paul in that school. But nevertheless, for Paul to have graduated from this school and to have this heritage, you know, the son of a Pharisee, becoming a Pharisee, growing up at home, again, and this is a very important thing to understand as far as Paul's background is concerned, growing up at home, in the home of a Pharisee, not only did his dad instruct him in the ways of the law and so forth, the Jewish customs and all that, along with what Paul got there at the synagogue school, but his dad would have been teaching him from the perspective of a Pharisee. Not just a Jew who knew the law, but a Pharisee. Now, again, this is very important because when it comes to being a stickler for the law, the Pharisees were very, very stickler-oriented. And you're going to see that here in just a few moments. Turn to Philippians chapter 3. We're continuing talking about Paul and his background. In Philippians chapter 3, beginning in verse 5, we get, you know, Paul's talking about his heritage, if you will. Circumcised the eighth day of the stock of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of the Hebrews, as touching the law, a Pharisee, concerning zeal, persecuting the church, touching the righteousness which is in the law, blameless. So he's basically letting people know, hey, this is who I am. So if you're thinking that I'm, you know, just some guy that decided he wanted to go around and start preaching something, you need to understand something about my background. If you think that I have no idea what it's like to be a Jew and to live under the law, I want you to realize something about me, because I do know these things. And he starts off talking about the fact that he was circumcised the eighth day. Well, this whole thing of circumcision started back in Genesis chapter 17, verse 12. Where God gave an instruction to Abraham, it was part of the covenant, it was a sign of the covenant, that he was to circumcise all the male members of his household, and those that were born into the household, they had to be circumcised as well. Well, in Leviticus chapter 12, verse 3, We see the introduction of circumcision to the law. That's when God said, okay, now another part of the law, tenet of the law, is that you have to be circumcised on the eighth day. That's just the way it was. That was the law that they lived under. Well, this whole thing of Abraham, if you read in several places in the New Testament, it speaks of Paul this way. It speaks of Jesus this way, of being the seed of Abraham. Well, and I forget the passage where Jesus is making the statement, or where they're saying this is being said about Jesus. But when it makes reference to the seed of Abraham, it's not just a matter of you're a Jew, but it's also a reference to the fact that you're a child of the covenant. So when somebody made the statement, well, I'm of the seed of Abraham, it wasn't just a matter of, well, I'm a Jew, but it also was like a reminder, I have a covenant with God. Because God struck that covenant back then with Abraham. In fact, it was the relationship that the Jews had with God was referred to in part as the covenant of Abraham, but then it was the law of Moses. It's never referred to as the law of Abraham. Or and in other places, it's referred to like the law of the covenant, so to speak. So it was the covenant of Abraham, but the law of Moses. So when you made reference to the fact that you're the seed of Abraham, you're making reference to the fact that not only am I a Jew, but keep in mind also that that Ishmael, the Ishmaelites and his descendants, they also called themselves descendants of Abraham, which they were, because, you know, Abraham, Ishmael, you know the whole story. But nevertheless, for a Jew to make that statement was like a reminder, I have a covenant with God. Instead of saying, I've got a covenant with God, you could say, I'm of the seed of Abraham. Meaning, I know what I have. I know that God's going to stand behind what I do, what I say, etc. and so forth, because my covenant goes all the way back to Abraham, and God doesn't break a covenant. So I'm of the seed of Abraham. But he makes this point about being circumcised on the eighth day. Making this declaration established him as compliant to the law from birth. Now, that might seem like a no-brainer. However, what's interesting is that not all Jew men, according to history, not all Jewish men were circumcised on the eighth day. Some of them were not circumcised until later on in life. I'll give you an example. In the Babylonian captivity, it would have been very difficult for all the Jewish baby boys to have been circumcised during that captivity. Now, I'm not saying that it was done on purpose. It's just that when they are in that kind of captivity, it could have been very difficult to have the, according to the law, follow the structure of the law to have that circumcision. And so there were some men that, Jews, who could not say that I was circumcised on the eighth day. So in essence, it's like Paul is saying, okay, let's everybody get together and compare notes, all right? Let's see who is the most legalistic in the bunch. First off, let's go back to childhood. All those that were circumcised on the eighth day remain standing. Everybody else, sit down. So all the men who were not circumcised on the eighth day had to sit down. You know what that did? That meant that you weren't fully compliant to the law. I mean, not exactly the way the law was written. Because the law said, eighth day, circumcision. So not only was Paul able to stand up and say, hey, I was circumcised on the eighth day. Were you? And if they said no, then people would say, well, okay, Paul, you got us there. But not only did it mean that he could use that as a part of his credentials, but it also said something about his parents. Because for him to say that he was circumcised on the eighth day, how many of you know eight-day-old babies don't make a whole lot of requests other than for food, right? So as an eight-day-old baby, he was totally at the mercy of his parents. But his parents were the ones that saw to it that he was circumcised. So by saying, I was circumcised on the eighth day, what he was saying is, I was raised in a home where, by golly, we follow the law. And my mom and dad, I mean, from the moment I was born, they're preparing me to be compliant with the law. And on the eighth day, they had me circumcised. So he's not just making reference to himself, but he's also making reference to his heritage. And again, it meant that he was raised in a very Jewish home. He makes the next statement here. If you look in verse 5, see, he says, of the stock of Israel. Well, you know, again, that's one of those English statements that, okay, big deal, stock of Israel. What's next? But to the Jews, in the, and I didn't put it down in the Hebrew, but that was a statement in the Hebrew that was a very, very powerful statement. What it meant was you had the ability to track your heritage all the way back to, you know, wherever, and prove that no outside blood had mixed in your family. Now, again, this was something not all Jews could say, because during, for example, again, the Babylonian captivity, you know, you talk about the 70 years of captivity and so forth. Well, during that time, there were a lot of situations where the Jews began to marry outside of the Jewish religion. They began marrying Gentiles. Do you remember in Nehemiah, there's the story of the Samaritans. Well, no, not... It's the origin, really, of the Samaritans is in Nehemiah. Remember a guy named Sanballat? Go back and read the book of Nehemiah. Well, long story short, some Jews married non-Jews, and it brought into existence the Samaritans. And you can pinpoint this back during the time of Nehemiah when they were rebuilding Jerusalem, the wall of Jerusalem. The Samaritans were considered, you know, the lowest scum of the earth. Okay? Well, you had other Jews that weren't considered Samaritans. The reason they're called Samaritans is because in Samaria, Mount Samaria, that's where Sanballat and his bunch began to gather, and they made that like their capital. Remember Jesus was ministering to the lady at the well? She's a Samaritan. And she asked the question about worship. You know, you Jews say we're supposed to worship in Jerusalem. We say that we're supposed to worship here at this mountain. And Jesus says, hey, the hour is coming, and now it is, when those that worship God must worship him in spirit and in truth. Okay? So Jesus, in essence, he was saying, they're both wrong. It's not about a city or a mountain. It's about a heart relationship with the Heavenly Father. Well, anyway, when Paul makes the statement that I'm of the stock of Israel, what he was saying is this. Guys, I've got the pedigree. I've got the papers. I can show you my history. And I can prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that I am a Jew. See, one of the major problems they had, if you go back and you read in the book of Nehemiah, you can see some of this. They had, when they came out of captivity, there were a lot of men who wanted to be Levites. Because remember, during captivity, they weren't allowed to do the Jewish Levite law stuff, okay? Well, they come out of captivity, and, you know, everybody wanted to be a Levite because it meant people gave you stuff. People, go back and read the law. The people had to bring in. The tithes that were brought in went to the priests, okay? In other words, when the priests had like the tenth of the grain offering, or the tenth, okay, you with me on this? Those things went to the priests to help support them. And so everybody wanted to be a priest because it meant you could sit back and have everyone bring things to you, in essence, all right? But unless you were able to prove that you were a Levite, in other words, unless you had the papers to prove it, then you weren't allowed to be a Levite. Well, because of Jerusalem being destroyed and so forth, a lot of the records were destroyed. And so it is believed, and rightfully so, I'm sure, that a lot of men who were of the tribe of Levi could no longer serve as priests because they didn't have the papers to prove it. The papers had been destroyed. But Paul is saying, my family made it through the dispersion. My family made it through the captivity. Our records made it through. And bless God, I can stand here and prove to you that I am of the stock of Israel. We didn't mix our blood with anyone. We know who we are. We know our background. So can you see how that what he's doing is he's one by one, group by group, he's eliminating a whole lot of people who might stand up and say, Paul, you're a nothing. Why should we listen to you? You know, what can you stand on to prove to us you're worthy of our attention? And he says, fine, let's talk about Jews. Let's talk about what it means to be a Jew. Circumcised on the eighth day of the stock of Israel. In other words, I can prove it. I've got the papers to prove it. And he goes on and he says, the tribe of Benjamin. Now, boy, when he said this, he got some attention. Because it's not only the stock of Israel, not only can I prove that we didn't mix blood, but folks, I'm of the tribe of Benjamin. Now, this was a major statement because it meant that he was able to trace his heritage literally to the very elite of Israel. Now, what's interesting, if you do much reading on Jewish history, you're going to find out that it wasn't so much the tribe of Levi or the tribe of Judah that got a whole lot of respect. I mean, they did, okay? And we talk a lot about the tribe of Levi, and we talk about a lot about the tribe of Judah. You know, Jesus, the tribe of Judah, and so forth. But the tribe of Benjamin was like the... The negative aristocracy, they because they had a history of being bad to the bone. The tribe of Benjamin, they liked to fight. They were like a warrior tribe in Jewish history. If back then, if they could have had motorcycle gangs, I guarantee you, the tribe of Benjamin would have had Harleys and black leather jackets and tattoos and earrings and nose rings and everything else. That's just kind of how they were. And just do a study sometime. Just type in Benjamin in a computer, like a search engine in your, like a Bible software or whatever. Just do a study on Benjamin and see all the passages wherein they are associated. There are two places, I don't know that I've got this written down, but there are two places in the Old Testament where there's a phrase, after thee, Benjamin. One is in Hosea, and I forget where the other one is. After thee, Benjamin. Well, what that statement is, it was like, have you ever heard the term Tippecanoe and Tyler too? No. In other words, you need to do your Ohio history as well. Praise the Lord. Okay, well, that was a campaign slogan for a presidency, okay, many years ago. Well, anyway, the statement, after thee, Benjamin, was like a phrase, a popular phrase. And the reason that phrase was so popular was because Benjamin liked to get into the battle, man. They liked to, you know, put a hurt on some people. And so the thing of after thee, Benjamin, it was this. You lead us into battle, we'll follow you, and we know we're going to win. After thee, Benjamin. Okay? A call to arms. And that appears two times in the Old Testament. Well, the tribe of Benjamin, it was considered as like an elite tribe. Benjamin, when you go back and read in Genesis, he was the son of Rachel. And Rachel, if you remember, was Jacob's favorite wife. So that automatically gave you a little extra status. Plus, Benjamin, out of the 12, Benjamin was the only one born in the promised land. So, you know, we're talking more and more pedigree the whole time. Saul, Israel's first king, he was a Benjamite. Remember, God said, you guys don't need a king. The people said, yeah, we do. And so, who becomes the first king? Saul. And by the way, it is believed, though I cannot prove this, but it is believed by most theologians that Paul, whose name was Saul, was named after Israel's king. And even if he wasn't, just to be able to stand up and say, my name is Saul and I'm from the tribe of Benjamin, immediately the people are going to think back to their first king. And they're going to make an association. Even if it was an incorrect association, they would have made this association. So he's standing there and he's telling the people this. And to the Jews hearing this, it's like, we're crying out loud, man. Is there anything that you aren't? Well, he goes on, or talking more about the tribe of Benjamin. When the 12 tribes split, only Benjamin remained with Judah. Now, one of the reasons that is very important, go back and read in the Old Testament the prophecies about the Lion of the tribe of Judah, about Jesus, about the Messiah, there shall come one out of Judah, and so on. When you go back and you read about this, the Jews had an understanding there was something special about the tribe of Judah. So for Benjamin, out of the 12, to be the only tribe to lock arms with Judah, that carried some weight. And the people understood that. And as I kind of implied already, Benjamin was at the forefront of battles to defend Israel. So being from the tribe of Benjamin would have earned him a tremendous amount of respect. And he goes on, if you look here in verse 5, and he says, I am a Hebrew of Hebrews. You say, okay, well, what in the world does that mean? Well, over the centuries, as I've mentioned before, there were a lot of times of Jewish captivity, a lot of times of Jewish disbursement. Now, a person who was called a Hebrew of Hebrews was someone whose family had retained the Jewish language and customs. Now, you may think that that's, okay, well, why is that important? Well, because over the 70-year disbursement. Okay, let me give you an example. I was over in Korea, and there was a couple there who had been born in Korea, but had lived in the United States for 40 years. And they had just gone back to Korea within the last year, you know, prior to my being over there. And as I was talking with them, their English was fabulous. And as I was talking with them, the lady said, hey, listen, Because there was something came up, and I was asking for an explanation, and they couldn't explain it. And then she looked at me and she said, "Hey, listen, we're new here just like you." In other words, they had been born and raised in that culture. Now, at one time, they could have answered anything I asked. But because they had been separated from that culture for 40 years, some of the things that they had been raised, you know, doing or knowing and understanding, they kind of lost it over time. And I've heard of other people who have moved from country number one to country number two and lived in country number two for such a long time, that for so many years, that when they went back to country number one, they had forgotten what certain words meant. Okay? Now, for him to say that I'm a Hebrew of Hebrews, what that meant, that again, that was another one of those kind of phrases that was important to the Jews. What that meant to them was that his mom and dad and his grandparents and his great-grandparents, etc. and so forth, all down through history, they fought, you know, not physically, but within their homes, they fought to retain their heritage. Which means while other Jewish families were being absorbed into the culture, forgetting how to speak Hebrew, because, again, Nehemiah is a really good book to read to get a glimpse of this. In Nehemiah, I believe, and I forget the where it is, but there's a reference, I believe, to the Jews having forgotten their language. If it's not Nehemiah, it's one of the prophets, but I think it might be in Nehemiah. I probably should have looked it up before tonight. Amen. But anyway, there's a reference to some of them who were struggling to speak in the Hebrew tongue. Well, that's because they've been separate 70 years. I mean, think about it, 70 years. That's a long time to be away from the motherland. So over time, they had forgotten some of their customs. In fact, if you remember, I think again in Nehemiah, at one point, or it might have been in Ezra. Ezra and Nehemiah are companion books. Excellent reading about the history of Israel. But nevertheless, it was either in Ezra or Nehemiah where they found a copy of the scroll. And they were so excited because we finally found something that we can refer to help us get back on track. And this was very important to them. But to be able to say that you're a Hebrew of Hebrews meant that, hey, listen, my mom and dad, grandpappy and great-grandpappy and all the rest of them, buddy, they never forgot where they came from. And they taught the customs. And even though during the times of dispersion and captivity and so forth, we weren't able to follow the customs exactly the way we'd like to, and we couldn't, you know, go to the temple or to the tabernacle and offer the sacrifices the way that we would desire and according to the law, because, you know, our captors kept us from doing a lot of these things, but yet this stuff was taught in our home. And so when Paul said, I'm a Hebrew of Hebrews, what he's saying is, hey guys, listen, man, my family stayed true to this thing. And they did everything they could, even during persecution. They did everything they could to instill in my dad and his dad and his dad before him the fullness of what it meant to be a Jew, the fullness of our customs, the fullness of our laws. Now again, I know we're giving a lot of background here, but I'm hoping you're starting to see how important this background is to understanding why Paul wrote a lot of the things that he wrote. Because when it came to him writing these different letters to the, the Christians and so forth, especially to the Jewish Christians, he could identify any problem. He could identify anything that was going on and clarify it, because this guy knew. This guy had an incredible understanding of the, now listen, of the difference between living under the law and living under grace. And he could explain it. And that's, we're going to get into this in Romans. It's powerful. And so to say that you're a Hebrew of Hebrews, this was a statement literally of ethnic purity. Well, he goes on to say, as touching the law, a Pharisee. Now, again, keep in mind, he's working down this checklist of, you know, bragging rights, so to speak. You know, you guys want to criticize me and say I have no right to stand up and preach and teach to you? All right, fine. Here's my pedigree. Not only am I this, not only am I that, but I'm also a Pharisee. And a son of a Pharisee. Hallelujah. I'm a Pharisee. Well, throughout Jewish history, when the Pharisees first came into existence, there was never any more than 6,000 Pharisees at a time. 6,000 may sound like a whole lot, but 6,000 out of how many million? So really, there weren't that many percentage-wise. And the word Pharisee, this isn't the pure definition, but it means separated one. separated one. Now, the Pharisees were not priests, but a priest could be a Pharisee. In other words, the Pharisees considered themselves, some of them considered themselves to be beyond the priesthood, meaning we're more important than the priesthood. I know they're Levites, but we know better than they know. We are the super experts. They might be the experts, but we're the super experts. We know more than them. We're better than them. We keep the law better than them. We know what it means to be a Jew better than the Levites know what it means to be a Jew. And if you go back and you read in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the Gospels, you're going to see Jesus having more confrontations with Pharisees than priests. Well, just because you were a Pharisee, it didn't mean you were a priest. But if you were a priest, you could be a Pharisee. Okay? Because being a member of the Pharisee, it was a very elite club. It could be made up of anybody. It didn't have to be just a priest. And the Pharisees were extremely legalistic, both in the written law and in the Mishnah. The written law was what God had given to Moses, but the Mishnah was made up of oral law. Now, turn over to Matthew chapter 7. I'll give you an example of this. The Mishnah was made up of oral law. In verse 1, actually, it's not Matthew chapter 7. It might be Luke chapter 7. Then again, it might be Mark chapter 7. Then it might not even be in the New Testament, Helen. Well, we definitely have a typo here. All right, let me just make reference to it. There was a time when the Pharisees went to Jesus, and Jesus' disciples were getting ready to eat. And they looked at Jesus, well, it wasn't just the Pharisees, there were some others with them, but they looked at Jesus and they said, Jesus, how come your disciples don't wash their hands before they eat, holding to the traditions of the elders? And then it goes on, and I believe it might be Luke 17. Let's take a gander. And if not, I'll just keep winging it. Mark 17. Mark 7. Do I hear Mark 8? Do I hear Mark 9? Mark 7. Yeah, I want you to see this. Thank you. Yeah, Mark 7, chapter 1, verse 1. Then came together unto him the Pharisees and certain of the scribes. The scribes were considered like lawyers, experts in the law, which came from Jerusalem. And when they saw some of his disciples eat bread with defiled, that is to say, with unwashing hands, they found fault. For the Pharisees and all the Jews, except they wash their hands oft, eat not, holding the tradition of the elders. And when they come from the market, except they wash, they eat not, and many other things there be, which they have received to hold, as the washing of cups, the pots, the brazen vessels, and of tables. Then the Pharisees and scribes asked him, Why walk not thy disciples according to the tradition of the elders, but eat bread with unwashing hands? And then Jesus goes on and he begins, confronting them about this and exposing their hypocrisy. Now notice they didn't say according to the law. They said according to the traditions. This was an oral law. And what had happened was this. I'll kind of summarize it this way. These Pharisees, they were so gung-ho about the law. It's like they looked at it and said, okay, if God's happy with this, then I'll bet you He'd be happy if we did this too. Now if you go back into Leviticus, you're going to find various laws concerning the washing of things. Before you do this, before you do that. So what they did was they took an element of the law, truth, and they added to it to create their truth. But because of the way they taught it, they made it sound like, well, this came from God. Well, it didn't come from God. It came from them, but they wanted it to be from God. And so they created all these extra things that later became known as the Mishnah. That was the term that was used to refer to the oral law that was added to the written law. Now the Pharisees were experts, not just of the written law, but also of the Mishnah. And quite frankly, a lot of what Jesus encountered as far as the problems that came up during his confrontations with these guys had more to do with the Mishnah than it did with the law, but it also had to do with the law because they were abusing the law and misteaching it and so on and so forth. Many times they were teaching it, of their own gain. Nicodemus, for example, if you read in John chapter 3, he was a, in fact, I think in John chapter 3, verse 3 or 2, it makes mention of Nicodemus as being a member of the council, which indicates he was a ranking member of the Sanhedrin. But nevertheless, Nicodemus was a guy who would have taught the law correctly. Just read John 3 and you can kind of begin to pick up on this. But you had others that would teach the law in a way that was for their own profit. And you can see that different times as you read the confrontation that Jesus... You know, the same thing happens today, guys. You got some people that are going to preach the truth as truth. And you got other people that are going to preach the truth for their own benefit, for their own gain, to try and control people, to try and manipulate people, and so on and so forth. Same kind of thing goes on today. And we still have Mishnah today. We have people that will preach the Bible, and then they'll give their own oral versions of the Bible. And in fact, I had a sermon here not too long ago entitled, Are You Living by a Mishnah? And anyway, this is the kind of a thing. In fact, when we go through the book of Romans, I have no doubt that all of us are going to begin to see things that in Scripture that expose Mishnah teaching that we're hearing today or that we've been raised on today. Or maybe we hear it in our own churches still today. I don't know. But we're going to hear things that expose the wrong teaching that is going on in the body of Christ. It's going to be really, really interesting. Nevertheless, the Pharisees were very big on keeping not just the written law, but also the oral law, what came to be known as the Mishnah. The Pharisees were dogmatic and totally unyielding with regard to the law, totally sold out to living according to all the law declared. And they considered themselves to be, you know, way beyond the typical person. The super strict Pharisees would not even allow the skirt of their robe to touch an ordinary man. I mean, I guess they didn't walk down crowded streets or something. I don't know what all they did. They had to avoid it. You remember when Jesus talked about relative to offerings? I forget the passage. Relative to offerings, he's talking about sounding the trumpet. Well, that had to do with the giving of offerings in such a way that it brought attention to yourself. Look what I'm giving. Remember when it talked about standing on the street corner and praying? Would Jesus talk about that? Well, what would happen is some of these Pharisees would actually have somebody like, you know, their little yes man would stand out there and like make this grand proclamation that Pharisee Bob is getting ready to pray. And everybody be quiet while Pharisee Bob prays. So Pharisee Bob would then, oh, most holy God. You know how it is today. People get all King Jamesy and so forth. Well, I don't know what they got back then, but nevertheless, it sure wasn't King Jamesy. But nevertheless, Pharisee Bob, you know, this is the kind of thing that they would do because they felt like it would enhance their status. Well, you know, Jesus confronted some of that stuff. But these super strict Pharisees, man, they were just, you know, obnoxious about this. And they looked down their nose at other people. Not all of them now, not all 6,000. There were good ones, so to speak. But nevertheless, it was a problem. The religion itself had become God. And yet they thought by doing their religious thing, they were serving God. And yet God sends his son down here and says, you guys are wrong. And they wouldn't listen to him. Well, continuing on here on these Pharisees, Paul was a Pharisee of Pharisees. Turn to Galatians chapter 1. I want you to see this. Galatians chapter 1. Take a look at verse 14. Paul's talking about himself. And profited in the Jews' religion above many my equals in mine own nation, being more exceedingly zealous of the traditions of my fathers. What he's saying there is this, where he talks about many my equals in mine own nation. Notice he doesn't say just of the Jews. He says many my equals in mine own nation. Okay, now think of it this way. A brain surgeon says, look, I have exceeded many of my equals in the medical profession. Okay, now what would the equals be? Other brain surgeons. The profession is the medical profession, but the equals would be the brain surgeons. When Paul says, I've exceeded beyond many of my equals in my own nation, it's almost like he was saying, I've gone way beyond the Pharisees of the Jewish nation. So he's saying, look, I'm a Pharisee of Pharisees. Now, it almost maybe sounds like he's bragging about himself, but he's not. In Galatians, and we're not teaching Galatians, But in Galatians, one of the things that was going on, there were other Jews who had come in and discredited Paul. You know, Paul talks about, oh, foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you that you've gotten off track here? Well, what had happened is these other people came in and they said, this guy Paul, man, he's a nobody. I mean, okay, he may have done a few good things and, you know, maybe raised a few of your dead family members and all that, but he's a nothing. You know, you don't need to pay attention to him. You need to listen to us. We'll tell you the right way. And so Paul comes along and he says, look, if you guys have got a problem with who I am, let me remind you something. I was a Pharisee, way beyond many of my equals in my own nation, or as members of the Jews. The Pharisees like Paul, they would have instructed Gentiles of the Jewish ways. Now let me kind of explain this here. There were a lot of Gentiles that were convinced that Jehovah was the only God. Now one of the reasons for, well, if you go back and you read in Exodus, it talks about when they came out of Egypt, when the Jews came out of Egypt, it talks about that there were strangers among them. Well, that word strangers means non-Jews came out also. You know, we're led to believe that when the Jews left Egypt, it was just the Jews. No, it wasn't just the Jews. There were other non-Jews, there were non-Jews that went out with them, other people who were non-Jews that went out with them. And there were some problems that came up later on because of that. Well, all throughout history, remember Nineveh? Remember God sent, Jonah to Nineveh to preach. Jonah says, I ain't doing it. So he, you know, goes on a cruise. Storm blows up. They throw Jonah overboard. You know the story. Fish swallows him, throws him up. You know, he walks into the city like that. That's gross. And he preaches. And the king of Nineveh repents in sackcloth and ashes. And he stands up and he makes a declaration to the city. And he says, folks, we're a stinking bunch of sinners. Now we're going to listen to this guy, Jonah. And we're going to make things right before God. And then the whole city repents. What's Jonah do? Goes out and sits under a tree and complains about it. I get a kick out of that story. So anyway, all throughout history. In fact, in Daniel, there's a story of Hezekiah. Go back and read Daniel. I think it's in chapter 4 or chapter 3. But Hezekiah wrote it, not Daniel. Hezekiah was an author of part of the Bible. And that's a pretty interesting thing. But what he's talking about in there is how he got messed up and then he got back right with God. And how he made a proclamation that the God of Daniel is the true God. So all throughout history you had Gentiles who came to the recognition that this God of the Jews, now, there's something here about this. He must be the true, only, real, for sure God. And these all things we've been worshiping, they can't compare. But this God over here, this is the real God. And so the Pharisees, even though they had an aversion to Gentiles and considered them, you know, the scum of... In fact, there was a phrase in the Hebrew that Gentiles were the fuel for the fires of hell. That's kind of strong, is it not? But nevertheless, that's kind of the attitude of some of these guys. Well, if there was a Gentile that came to a synagogue or whatever, and he says, look, I know I'm fuel for the fires of hell, all right? But you guys have got something going here. And the God that you worship has got to be the real God. I want to be like you. I want to be right with the right God, the correct God, the only God. Well, the Pharisees, they would kind of deal with this, and they would invite these Gentiles, depending upon where the synagogue was located, they would invite them into the synagogue. You know, they definitely could not go into the temple. They couldn't go into the inner part of the temple. But they would invite them to come into a synagogue, and they would teach them the ways of being a Jew and what it meant. They would teach them the law. And they told them that, you know, you don't have a choice in this. I mean, if you want to convert, if you want to be a proselyte, if you want to be like us, man, you've got to keep the law, all the festivals. You've got to keep all the holy days. You've got to keep all the offerings and all of this. And by the way, you have to be sacrificed, or not sacrificed, circumcised. We'd like to sacrifice you, okay, but since you want to worship God, we'll just circumcise you. Now, granted, that sounds like sacrifice, and you may prefer sacrifice over circumcision. But nevertheless, you have to be circumcised. Now, you know, listen, if you're a grown man, Gentile, and you're willing to do that, you are serious. You are absolutely serious about this commitment you're willing to make. Now, see, you've got to understand, try to think of this from the perspective of a Pharisee. You got this Gentile, scum of the earth, and says, I'm going to worship your God. All right, well, law, teach, explain, feasts and all these things, Sabbath and so forth. And that Gentile says, okay, I can do that. I can do that too. All right, no problem. I can do that. Yeah, okay, I can kill that. I won't eat that anymore. No problem. And he says, all right, but there's this thing of circumcision. And that Gentile sits there and swallows really hard. He says, you mean I got a what? You have to be circumcised. And like, when? Can you do that? Like when I'm in the casket? Say, can we wait? No, you got it now. All right. If you're going to do this, if you want to be like us, you have to be circumcised. And that Pharisee's thinking, oh, we're going to know now. We're going to know how serious you are. And if that Jew said, or that Gentile said, okay, that's what it means, let's do it. Now, I guarantee you that would have made an impression on any Pharisee. I don't care how much they hated the Gentiles. If you got a Gentile that says, I'll do it, that's going to, well, maybe we've got something here. I bet this guy, he's got to be serious if he's going to do this. So you had these Gentiles who wanted to be Pharisees, who wanted to be Jews, and guys like Paul would have taught them all of the law. Okay, now, I'm not going to go very far into this other than to say, think about the things that Paul wrote in his letters concerning the Jews who were trying to proselyte or trying to enforce the law on other people. Paul had done it. So he knew what was going on, and he knew how to counter it because of his past. Okay, now, let's go ahead. We'll stop right here and pick up next time. So take about a 5-minute break. Come back at 9:45. We'll finish up for tonight.